from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with the Chief Education Officer for the White House Historical Association. Then we'll look at how this winter compares to last year, when we had record warmth.
When we look at long-term records over many, many years, there's an unmistakable upward trend in our temperatures, and we see that as an unmistakable downward trend in the ice cover.
Plus, we'll hear an essay from a Veterans Affairs employee sharing how the fork in the road email to federal employees impacted them.
If 2 million government employees are being encouraged to resign from their jobs, what evidence is backing this decision? What evidence points to the benefits of privatization?
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today is President's Day, and we're going to speak with a Wisconsin native tasked with preserving the history of the People's House, also known as the White House. The White House Historical Association was founded by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961 to help the White House collect and exhibit artifacts of American history and culture. It's a private nonprofit organization that works to preserve artifacts, pursue research, and provide education. Dr. Matthew Costello is a Wisconsin native who completed his doctorate and master's in American history at Marquette University. His lifelong passion for the subject led him to the White House Historical Association, where he serves as the Chief Education Officer. To tell us more about the role and what the job entails, Costello joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
So you grew up in Muskego, went to Pius High School, studied at UW-Madison, and completed your graduate work at Marquette University. Out of all these things, what experiences of your life here in Wisconsin shaped your interest and enthusiasm for studying history?
It's a great question. I think, you know, growing up, I remember the field trips to Old World, Wisconsin, you know, bringing your lunch in the pail. And another thing that I did at one point one summer, I worked in the Sissel shoe shop. I worked in the general store. So I quite literally, you know, I played the part, so to speak, at Old World, Wisconsin itself. But I've just always been really interested in history. My parents, my dad especially, very interested in history, World War II. And so that was something that, you know, if he was watching something on TV, I might sit down and watch as well. And it just kind of became one of those things that I think it was part of the environment, part of, you know, my parents saying that was important. But then also, you know, we had opportunities to go visit historic sites, visit museums, come out east to Washington, D.C., go to Mount Vernon, go to Monticello. So, you know, I got bit by the history bug early, and it's never really gone away.
Speaking of Mount Vernon, one topic of history you're particularly passionate about is George Washington, but your dissertation at Marquette focused on something that people may not expect. It wasn't about his accomplishments while he was alive, but how people remember him, right? Can you explain that?
I've long been very interested in how we talk about history, how people remember historic figures, historic events, because it's sort of this ongoing dialogue between whatever's happening today in the contemporary and what has happened and how people choose to remember those things. And I think those choices are very critical to understanding sort of their mindsets, their political, their social, their cultural mindsets, and understanding their own relationship to the past. And, you know, that is not a uniquely American thing. I mean, that's something that communities, people, you know, states, all different sized groups think about their past and their traditions and these things. And also upon my advisor's recommendation, you know, she had told me, you know, if you're going to write about George Washington, you're going to have to take a different approach. There's been a lot of books written about George Washington. And so when I told her the dissertation isn't really about George Washington, it's about how people remembered George Washington, which tells us something entirely different. It wasn't really about Washington's deeds or his accomplishments or his failings, but it was about how people decided to remember those things. And so ultimately that led to the dissertation and then the first book. And needless to say, George and I we've been very close for a long time.
So while George Washington never, you know, stayed in the White House, it wasn't built at that time during his presidency, Can you share a bit about what the White House Historical Association is and the history behind its founding and mission?
Of course. We were founded in 1961 at the request of First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy to enhance the public understanding of the White House and the people who live there and work there. And since that time, we've worked with every administration. For many years, we had really more of a role as a fundraiser and raising awareness. You know, the federal government only appropriates money for things like maintenance and upkeep. But if we're talking about things like fine and decorative arts, if we're talking about things like presidential and first lady portraiture, new artwork, state services, I mean, these are things that are generally now paid with by private money. And a lot of it is through the White House Historical Association. And so in addition to acquisition, conservation, and preservation projects, we also have an educational mission. And as the chief education officer and director of the Rubenstein Center, this is really the hub that oversees our teacher training, our field trip program now with the People's House, which is a new visitor experience in Washington, our research and scholarship with our team of historians, our fellows, both academic and research. And then also, we also have a digital library, which has more than 30,000 publicly available images of the White House and various things at the White House. So our big message with the Rubenstein Center has been to encourage new scholarship about the White House, encourage younger professionals who are interested in researching and writing about the White House or the people who live there and work there, but also to make this history more accessible and more readily available for everyone.
The White House is also a unique national, it's not quite a national monument, it's like a living monument, right? Because there are presidents that occupy it, there's staff, there's events, a whole range of things. And this is much different compared to, say, going to the Jefferson Memorial. So can you share a bit about kind of the fun challenge it is to work for a place that has so much history, but still constantly needs to evolve?
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point. The White House really is, it's a, you know, home, office, stage, museum, but all at the same time, an event space. And you know, that's what it is used for a lot of the time, between the public tours, between bill signings, press conferences, state visits. You know, the White House is constantly being transformed and turned over for the next event or the next event, or the next event. And so, you know, even though we are the private partner, so we're not directly involved with those types of things, but you know, we're supportive of the White House and the executive resident staff that is tasked with doing a lot of those things. And that staff, it really is sort of the continuity of the house, because as you mentioned, presidents and first ladies and first families come and go, but the executive resident staff really stays there. Many of them stay there for years, some even stay for decades. And they really are the continuity of the institution of the White House. And so you go to Mount Vernon and you'll talk to the interpreters and they tell you that the house is essentially set in 1799 when George Washington died. So then it's just sort of like, okay, that's it. That's the end point, 1799. Everything you're looking at, 1799. But you can't really do that with the White House, because every day a new page of that history is being written. And so for us, I think the most challenging part has been, you know, we are a historic organization. We are an educational organization. So how do we balance serving that role and giving people context, giving people nuance, but also, you know, staying clear of whatever is happening in the contemporary, right? So we generally don't talk about policy or politics of any administration that's in office, but, you know, after they leave and they become a historic example, you know, then it's something that we do, it does kind of then fall more into our mission.
Yeah. Can you share a little more detail about how these things shape what your day-to-day looks like? When we were first getting in touch, obviously the funeral of President Carter was happening, mm-hmm. and then the upcoming inauguration, and those things kind of impact, okay, what are people asking us to research or explain? So yeah, can you just share some insights about mm-hmm. what it looks like, and you know, do you have the flexibility to choose what you're researching or working on, or is that dependent on the requests that come through?
I would say it's a little bit of both. We have some of our own projects that are ongoing that we've been working on. And then, you know, as you mentioned, there are times where things happen, there are historic occasions and moments that happen, and then we need to sort of, you know, pivot and quickly be able to talk about those things. And it can be challenging because, you know, all of a sudden I've become an expert in White House Easter egg rolls. I've become an expert in Christmas decorations. That's not something I ever would have imagined that I would be doing in grad school, but I see it as it's part of the job. And when there's interest in the White House or things that are happening at the White House, people want to know the history behind those things. And so a lot of these seasonal and holiday things we can plan and we can anticipate. But then when we get notice that there's going to be a state arrival, there's going to be a state dinner, well, then we need to sort of pivot and be ready, because typically people want to know, has this country ever visited, or has this leader ever visited, and when was the last time they visited, and they start asking those questions. And so I see it as our role to be the authoritative source for answering those type of things. And so sometimes it can be something like, when was the last canceled egg roll, which was something that came up during the pandemic. Or it can be, when was the last time the president of France visited? So, it can be very dependent upon sort of the current events and what's happening, and how can we add a little bit of historic context to what people are seeing. But then it can also be, and I would say most of the time, we're spending our time working on our own research projects, articles, resources.
Well, and having both of those aspects to juggle, what do you think are the pros and cons of being a historical generalist, in the work that you do?
Well, I think that the pro obviously is that you probably have at least one insightful thing to say about everything. But then the downside of that is there are certain topics that you obviously feel more comfortable talking about, or you can go deeper. And then there are other topics that you probably do just have to give a very basic explanation, because either you haven't had time to go deeper, or you haven't read up or researched more on a particular topic. And so that does happen. And when it does happen, I think you just have to be quite honest, and you say the words that everyone dreads saying, I don't know. That's something that I'd have to look into, and I'd have to, do a little bit more research. And typically when that kind of stuff happens, I mean, I feel like it's a much better policy to just say, I don't know. I could look into that, and I could send you whatever I find. And so you just kind of have to be honest with whoever you're talking to that you may not have all the answers. And I think that's a there's a big misconception about people just assume because it's the White House that everything has always been minutely documented about absolutely everything that's ever happened in the White House. That is not the case. In fact, what we think of today as how the presidency is minutely documented minute by minute, that's really more like a post World War II type development. And so, if you're talking about anything from White House history before 1945, documentation and evidence really varies depending on the era, depending on the people, depending on the staff. And so I think a lot of people are surprised when if I say like, I don't know, or I can't find an answer. But when in fact, there's still a lot that we don't know about the White House. And that's a big part of the push that we're making in trying to encourage young professionals, emerging scholars, to do more work that can help us teach more about the White House, and teach more Americans about the White House.
When you come across those situations of, hold on, we need to look into that more, what's a question that either came in recently or in your tenure that stuck out to you? Whether you could find the answer or not, something that was intriguing and kind of sent you on a fact hunt, so to speak.
Well, just very recently, we had a question come into our research inbox, and sometimes we do get these questions. It is, an individual who is looking for more evidence about a family story or a family legend or a family tradition. And this particular person was curious about, I think it was a third great grandfather, and they had always heard sort of, through their family that this person worked at the White House as a gardener. And then they had also heard that he was involved in building Abraham Lincoln's catafalque. Catafalque is the raised platform that they put the casket on when they have the lion in state ceremony at the Capitol Rotunda. They built one after Lincoln was assassinated. They also built one for the White House because that was where Lincoln had his funeral service. And so, I corresponded with this person. I checked sort of all the different places I knew to check. I was able to at least find the official register. They print all the names of government employees, throughout the 19th century, and they tell you the department they report to and their salary, where they were born, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was able to find her descendant's name, but I was just kind of like, I think based on this, it's certainly plausible that, your descendant worked on the grounds because they were listed as a laborer for the public grounds and works. But I also pointed out, because they weren't designated as White House, they probably moved around a lot, right? They may have been a gardener at the White House, but they probably also did work in other places in DC because it was all of the public buildings. And so, having those kind of opportunities where I can try to use sort of my research, muscles and acumen to try to help people find out a little bit more detail about a family member, or, to try to figure out if a story that they've always heard has any legitimacy or authenticity to it. Those are the types of inquiries I think are really interesting, because you really kind of go into a deep dive with somebody else, and it's a very personal story for them too.
Absolutely. And it touches upon this theme of legacy that you've been drawn to, that you've studied. So from that dissertation at Marquette to the work you're doing now, how has your thoughts on the concept of legacy either been reaffirmed or changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the things that I always grappled with Washington was this idea of how does the individual that we're talking about shape legacy, even if they're not there? And I think the initial explanation is, well, they're not there, so they're not shaping legacy. But what I found is, even though Washington may not be there, or really you could take anyone, you could take Jimmy Carter as an example, he's not there, but how is he shaping how we remember him? And it's through things like state funerals. It's through things like their family members, their supporters. And so this idea that presidents or, important American historical figures can shape their legacy even beyond, the time that they leave this life. I mean, that's a very real thing. And, to see that play out, not only with how I studied it with George Washington, but then most recently to see it with President Jimmy Carter, I think it just sort of reaffirms that the figures themselves are active participants in that legacy making process.
Well, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share not only your job, but your passion. I really enjoyed learning more.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, and I'm glad I could be on. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Matthew Costello is the Chief Education Officer for the White House Historical Association. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, a federal employee shares their reaction to the Trump administration's offer to resign. But first, we'll compare this winter to last winter, when we had record warmth, and we'll learn how warming winters are impacting the state's agriculture. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin winters are warming. Last winter marked the warmest since 1895, and this trend is expected to continue as greenhouse gas emissions persist. WUWM series Thin Ice 2025, Wisconsin's Warming Winters, explores these changes through the voices of residents, experts, and stakeholders. To understand what this winter can tell us about recent warming trends, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met with Steve Vavris, the state climatologist.
This winter is shaping up to be much more normal, whatever normal means anymore.
You probably hesitate saying normal, right?
I do. It's hard to say what's normal anymore. December was much more typical than last December, which was the warmest December on record a year ago, 2023. January, interestingly here, at least in southern Wisconsin, has been colder than normal, and by a few degrees. And normally that wouldn't be so memorable or meaningful, but so few months lately have been colder than normal at all. And to be colder than normal by a few degrees is really noteworthy. I think most of us feel like, wow, it's pretty darn cold this January. And that used to be typical, but it's become atypical. And so we notice it more.
The conditions that you described last winter when ice was in some areas absent or, you know, was much reduced. So what do you see happening?
We definitely have much more ice, extensive ice cover around Wisconsin this winter.
Yeah.
And we did have the big warm up in late December, right between Christmas and New Year's. And so any ice that formed either barely survived or some of it melted off and then refroze again when we had the colder weather in January. And here in Madison, where we have a really long ice record in Lake Mendota going back to the early 1850s, it temporarily froze on Christmas Day and then didn't last more than 2 days and then melted off and then froze for good beginning January 7th. And because we've had such cold weather ever since, we have a pretty solid ice cover on Mendota, but still there can always be fractures and leads and funny currents under the ice that can cause you to be in an unsafe spot.
So it has to be difficult for scientists to do the research, to track what's happening, to, you know, study that. And as you said, you're still looking at last winter, and to be able to convey the fact that our climate is changing and maybe we have winter right now, what feels like real winter. We can't even say likely, right? It's not going to be the same over time.
Right. So winter is the season that's the most variable in terms of temperature. We have variability in Wisconsin in every season, of course, but winter is the most. And we see that even day to day, we can, you know, drop to 20 below zero, and then in another day or two, we're up in the 30s. So that's pretty common during winter to have these wild swings. And so that can make it difficult to tease out a long-term warming signal, because you do have days that are cold, you have particular Januaries that are cold, and sometimes whole winter seasons. But when we look at long-term records over many, many years, there's an unmistakable upward trend in our temperatures, and we see that as an unmistakable downward trend in the ice cover. The amount of ice cover, the days with ice cover, the thickness of ice, those are all shrinking, and that's consistent with the overall warming climate.
So another element of this series took me to Door County, and I spoke with a commercial fisherman and to a guide. The core of their catch is whitefish, and the bay side is the fish are doing better there. They're far more abundant. So in speaking with this guide, he was fishing as a kid. You know, he's one of those people who lived in that region, and long before he thought about making a career of it, he was out with his dad. He said what he is experiencing, even when it's cold, that it's windy, and he doesn't remember really cold, windy weather as a kid. Is that wind something that is associated with our climate changing?
It's a great question about wind and how it's changing, if at all, in our climate. Wind is a frustrating variable if you're a climatologist. And the reason is that we've had changes in wind sensors over the years. And that makes it incompatible to look at long-term trends.
Interesting.
Yeah, so even at big airports like the one in Milwaukee or the one in Madison, long records, high quality for the most part, but the problem is that in the middle 1990s, the Weather Service transitioned from human observers of wind and a certain anemometer is the term for the wind measure, a certain type of anemometer, and all of that equipment switched to an automatic weather station. So it saved having to pay people to do these measurements, and it all became automated. And right in the middle 90s, you see across the board a big apparent drop in wind speed. But it's not because the wind suddenly weakened in the middle 90s. It's because the way we measure the wind changed. And so we have this discontinuity in our long-term records, which makes it difficult to know, is it windier or less windy than it was 50 years ago? We don't have a good answer for that. A similar problem for clouds. Cloud measurements used to be done by humans. pretty good measured, measurements. Then when we had these automated weather stations, which are great for other things, but now cloud measurements are done differently. And so they're not comparable to the way it used to be done before that. So those are two variables that are frustrating in the sense that we don't really have a good sense of their long-term trends in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
I want to swing back. You've mentioned that there's some research that you've been able to launch. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so the State Climatology Office, housed here at UW-Madison, is working on a lot of different things. We're primarily about climate services to try to make weather and climate information most effectively used across the state. Part of that is investigation, research, trying to figure out what has happened in Wisconsin's climate in the past, where are we going, and why it's happened. So one example of that is a simple question of snowfall. Are Wisconsin's winters getting snowier? And that's surprisingly difficult to answer because the way snowfall is measured nowadays is different than it was in years past. So you can't simply look at the reports of snowfall now and in the past. You have to really kind of discern and make an assessment. We have different pieces of data that we're analyzing. We have made some progress in the last year. For instance, we've discovered the significant statewide trend that appears to be occurring since 1895 is primarily happening in the northern third of Wisconsin. There are some increases elsewhere in the state, but the big increase that's accounting for the statewide average increase is coming from the northern tier of Wisconsin.
So you're saying we have more snow today?
If you look at the raw snowfall data, in particular, we've had some very snowy winters in the past 20, 25 years or so, and that is believable. But the question is, those snowy winters in the past 25 years or so, how do they compare with snowy winters of the past? The snowy winters of the past don't appear to have had as much as recent winters, but maybe it's just because they didn't measure snowfall the same way. Maybe if they used modern techniques, they would have had similar numbers to what we see recently.
If one here gathers snippets of this information, you might hear, well, more snowfall, so what's the worry? Maybe things are okay.
That's one of the reasons we want to figure out, is the snowfall trend real or is it spurious just based on measurement differences? But if it is real, one possibility is because winters are getting more moisture in the air in a warming climate. And so if you have more moisture in the air and you're below 32 degrees, you can get more snowfall. That's a possibility. We do know that the winters have been seeing more precipitation overall. That could be more rain, it could be more snow, it could be more of both. But at the same time, there's evidence that we're seeing less snow cover, especially thick snow cover. And so we could be getting more snowfall, but then we have more winter warm-ups and the snow doesn't last as long, and now we have more bare ground than we used to. We're also studying something novel, and that is the duration of time we're spending below freezing. So this is a different way of measuring climate. Rather than saying what's the temperature, how much below or above normal is the temperature, it's just a simple binary calculation. Is a particular hour of time in the past above freezing or below freezing? And that really matters because so many things depend on that 32 degree threshold. That determines whether we get snow or rain in the winter, for example. It affects whether the snowpack survives. It affects lake ice cover, for example. It affects all sorts of things. And so we think this is an interesting way of measuring climate and variability. And we have records going back reliably to the early 1950s. So we have about 75 years of data at this point. And what it's showing is, consistent with the warming climate, we are seeing fewer hours in Wisconsin and nationwide below freezing. What's interesting is the differences across the state. You can see certain places in certain months that show bigger declines, some not as big. But what's striking is that of all the months we were looking at during the course of the year, March is the month that's showing the biggest decline in the time spent below freezing. And to the point where at the beginning of our record in the early 1950s, most of the time Wisconsin was below freezing during March. And now, in recent decades, most of the time we are above freezing during March. So that more or less represents a shift from March going from a winter month in the past to now becoming a spring month. That's a fundamental change.
So if we try to tie this conversation up with a bow, and we don't know exactly how things will end with this winter and when spring will spring, but how would you put it in context?
Well, I think we can learn some lessons from places that have a warmer average climate than we do. For instance, southern Wisconsin is trending toward the climate of northern Illinois. And so we can learn lessons from places like that. We've essentially had stress tests lately when we have these extremes, whether it's an extreme for a whole season or extreme heavy rainfall or extreme heat. Even though it's difficult, it's painful, it's expensive to go through these extremes like we have, the silver lining is that we can learn from them and become more resilient for the future.
Steve Vavris is the Wisconsin State Climatologist. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. For our Thin Ice series, Susan also spoke with Liz Griffith. She manages Door Creek Orchard, located just east of Madison, and shares how changing winters impact her family's orchard.
So let's back up to the history of this place. Your parents jumped into, is it orcharding? I'm sure it's not. Is it?
Orcharding works.
Can we create that word?
Yes. I like orcharding, yes. So they jumped into orcharding in 1983, and our family moved out here in 1984. And this was previously, before that, a Norwegian homestead, and obviously before that, indigenous land. But yeah, it was a long line of Norwegian farmers who were here on this property. There was someone who was renting from them that planted the first trees down here on this side of the road. And we do still have a few of those from the 1970s.
Wow. Talk about the care for your trees throughout the years. So now it's when the weather's right, you're pruning. And then as you move through the seasons, what happens?
Oh, so many things. Yes, there's always something for every season. So when we start to see green tissue in the spring, we have to start paying attention to weather conditions for disease and insect management, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of different cultural things we can do for that, one of which is pruning that we are doing now.
So what is the pruning? How does the pruning help the tree?
So the pruning is getting rid of a lot of, first of all, broken branches, diseased branches, branches that are just vegetative and just kind of blocking airflow and sunlight. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones you're looking to take out first. Mm-hmm. They're pretty obvious. Ones that are going backward, that are just there blocking airflow and sunlight, like I said. And then you're also looking to shape the tree for longevity and best fruit production. You can also think about with older trees like this, you can see we've selected new, like renewal branches, I'd call it. Mm-hmm. So that one lost its top, but over the past few years we've been growing a new top and it's doing great.
And you have a bunch of varieties, right?
We have 90 producing varieties right now.
Is that unusual for an orchard, or is that kind of the way it's done in general?
It is unusual, sadly. But there are other orchards out there like us.
And the idea is if you've got that variety, you've got a better chance of some doing better than others, depending on what you're dealing with weather.
Yes, I mean, diversity is the thing, right?
Sure,
for many reasons. Also, there's a really huge number of amazing apple varieties out there that people don't know about.
Yeah.
And we love them, and we want to preserve them and give people the chance to try them and know about them.
You've touched on diversity.
Yes.
It's also good. I mean, when you consider what's beneath our feet, you know, what's nurturing these trees, mm-hmm. that's all the diversity helps to nurture the soils. And does it impact the hydrology?
Oh, yeah. I mean, perennial farming is great for hydrology in general, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not tilling up the soil every year.
Right.
So we are no-till just by inherently being a perennial farm with perennial plants. But yeah, I mean, we hope that the root systems here. And, you know, we don't do herbicide strips under our trees for many reasons, and one of which would be hydrology. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all of the plants, we want all of the plants to help and have a community and grow the best fruit we can.
So when there's not snow and when it's not winter, what's underfoot? I mean, do you grow grasses or anything beneath?
We have some intentional plantings that I'm experimenting with in a smaller block next to my folks' house. It's generally an orchard grass mix in the aisles. Mm-hmm. We don't love vines. We have to go through and cut, you know, wild grape, bittersweet, mm-hmm. other things, nightshade sometimes, mm-hmm. out of the trees. Right now it looks very trimmed, like a golf course. And we have to do that going into winter because the rodents will come and chew the trees if there's cover for them.
Oh.
And with climate change, we've had a huge problem with that we've never had before.
Rodents being
voles.
Voles.
Both meadow voles and pine voles. And they go under and chew the roots.
How is climate change contributing to that?
So I would, specifically for the pine voles, mm-hmm. It used to get too cold consistently in the winters for them to survive. Because they're living below ground and they were traditionally further south, right?
Yeah.
And now it doesn't, so they can hang out.
So Liz, did you pick up all of this through your parents? Did you get extra? Did you go to school and say, okay, I'm gonna take it a step further?
I did learn a lot from my folks, absolutely. I have a degree in something totally unrelated.
Oh, tell me.
I have a BFA in musical theater, and I did that for a long time, was based out of New York City for 11 years. I did grow up on the orchard, learned a lot from my folks, and then when Noah and I moved back here with the idea of taking over, I did a lot more self-directed learning. I did go to UW Extension at the time, was offering quote-unquote Apple School, a three-day intensive, did a lot of reading.
So Liz, being away those years and stepping back in, you must have seen the climate impacting in a bigger way by then.
Yes, absolutely. It does not, and my dad, if he were here, would say the same thing. I mean, we are dealing now with a litany of things he never had to deal with. Just talking about the winters again, like just, you know, Wisconsin winters used to be snowy and cold and sunny, and it was consistently snowy and cold and sunny. And now we have these ups and downs and freeze-thaw. And that is... just that alone is difficult to deal with. So
explain what the stress that puts on a tree.
Yeah, so apple trees are, and this does vary between varieties like everything does, but apple trees are pretty hardy. Mm-hmm. In the fall, when things start cooling down, they gain dormancy, right? And they hit their peak dormancy when it gets the coldest, right? And they're able to handle it. If then you have a stretch of milder weather, they'll start to lose dormancy. And then if it drops back down again real abruptly, that's when you get tissue damage on the tree, roots, buds, things like that, because it's just not as dormant, it's not as hardy. So that's a big issue. And then, of course, in the spring, when we have really early warm-ups, like we did last year, for example, where bloom was a month early than it was supposed to be, the chances of returning to more, quote-unquote, normal temperatures, freezing temperatures, is much higher. So the chance then of the blossoms freezing off is much higher. So those two things are probably the main issue with how winters are now.
So what are your strategies? Have you made some modifications?
Cold air sinks, right? So when we're thinking about replanting earlier blooming trees, we're not doing it down on this level, this lower level. I have got some gaps in a row down here that had pears in it, which are all gone. Pears are also early blooming. I'm going to try American persimmon, which blooms really late. So we also have a pawpaw planting. They bloom later than apples and pears and stone fruit. Stone fruit are even earlier. I've looked into different nutritional sprays that you can do before and after to help trees recover from a freeze situation like that. And I have done that the past few years. We do frost fires sometimes, which the jury is out whether that works, but it's fun and it makes you feel better that you're doing something.
Explain that.
So we build fires at the bottom of the orchard and tend them there is some heat coming off of them. And then there's some anecdotal evidence that if you build a smoke layer over the top, it can create a little mini greenhouse effect too to trap heat. You know, we just need a few degrees a lot of the time to help mowing the grass, making sure the grass is really, really low before a freeze event. If you have a sunny day before, the soil can absorb more heat and then release the heat. So little things. I'm going to try to write a grant for a frost fan this spring, a portable frost fan run with a tractor PTO that'll suck the air from the top of the hill down here.
So yes, every day indeed. You wake up and say, okay, we're going to keep at it.
We're going to keep at it. I still love it most of the time. But pruning in particular is my favorite part of being an orchardist.
Because you're truly connected to the tree?
You're connected to the tree. You've got scientific rules, right, that you are trying to follow, but then it's very artistic. Also, you're shaping the tree. You're making choices about what you want the tree to do even like 3 years down the road. Yeah, you are really communing with the tree and working together to shape what you want, right? Yeah, it's really cool. I love it.
Liz Griffith manages Door Creek Orchard. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz for our Thin Ice series. Stay tuned to Lake Effect and Morning Edition all week to hear more reporting on Wisconsin's warming winters. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, a Veterans Affairs employee shares how the fork in the road email to federal employees has impacted them. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. On January 29th, over 2 million federal employees received an email from the U.S. Office of Personnel Management with the subject line, Fork in the Road. It was an offer for government workers to resign in exchange for pay and benefits through the end of September or remain in their jobs with no guarantee they would keep them. The offer had not been approved by Congress, and no funds had been allocated for this proposal. The fork in the road offer closed on February 12th, and about 3% of the federal workforce agreed to resign, despite there being no guarantee of that payout. And after issuing Tuesday's, U.S. District Judge George O'Toole declined to block the Trump administration's deferred resignation program. This email and the uncertainty around it caused a lot of stress for some federal employees, including a Veterans Affairs mental health clinical pharmacist practitioner who works in the Midwest. They share this anonymous essay.
On Wednesday, January 29th, I, along with 2 million other federal employees, received an email from the Office of Personnel Management with the subject line, Fork in the Road. It was the middle of my workday, and with a few minutes before my next appointment, I began to read, absorbing the words consolation, divestitures, reductions in force, and termination, feeling my stomach tighten. Eventually, I am able to piece together that I am being offered a buyout based on the notion that my work as a federal employee is a waste of taxpayer dollars. A follow-up email later in the week with a link to the FAQ would confirm this with the words, "We encourage you to find a job in the private sector. The way to greater American prosperity is encouraging people to move from lower productivity jobs in the public sector to higher productivity jobs in the private sector." The sensation in my stomach develops from a tight anxiety to a sickening anger. For context, after graduating pharmacy school, I completed 2 years of residency training at the Milwaukee Veterans Affairs Medical Center, specializing in psychiatric pharmacy my second year. In 2020, I took a job at another VA in the Midwest as a mental health clinical pharmacist practitioner in our substance use disorder clinic. This was a new role funded by the Office of Rural Health to increase access to care for veterans with substance use disorders living in rural areas. While in this role, I expanded access to medications for alcohol and opioid use disorders and was selected as a winner of the VA National Clinical Pharmacy Practice Office Strong Practice Competition. I currently work with our primary care mental health integration clinic, a team designed to offer same-day access. Every day, I see veterans who are seeking help for various mental health conditions and substance use disorders, and can see them the very same day they show up to a primary care appointment. Back at my desk, staring at my inbox, I read that we can expect a few agencies and even branches of the military to see increases in the size of the workforce. And yet, they are encouraging every single employee of the Veterans Health Administration, or VHA, to resign because we need to move from lower productivity jobs in the public sector to higher productivity jobs in the private sector. I feel as if I have been punched in the gut. The president of my country does not believe that the services provided by the VHA are valuable enough to continue funding. After several rereads, I am left with the sense that this new administration intends to effectively cut off our water supply and let us slowly dry up, regardless of the consequences. I take a deep breath, I close my email, and I go back to seeing my patients scheduled for the day. I listen to the veteran who's describing symptoms of sleeplessness and hyperarousal that stem back to a traumatic event occurring during their military career. They tell me how they have increasingly been relying on alcohol because that has been their only way to sleep without nightmares. They express worry about how their symptoms and alcohol use are negatively impacting their family. I listen, I summarize back to them, and I ask if there's anything else that would be important for me to know. I transition to asking questions about their priorities. I ask, out of all the things we have talked about, what is the most important to you? What do you want to focus on first? What tools would be most helpful for you right now? And then we talk about the tools. We talk about medication options, antidepressants, anti-craving medications, and medications for nightmares that decrease the hypersensitivity of the fight or flight part of the nervous system. We discuss options for referral to our specialty care clinics for evidence-based treatment for alcohol use or post-traumatic stress disorder. We explore whether they would like to participate in a VA clinical trial, evaluating a new smartphone application designed to help reduce drinking. We consider the option for virtual appointments in the case they are unable to drive to our clinic in the middle of their workday. I ask if the veteran has any questions about all the options we have discussed. And then, together, we make a plan. The appointment ends, and in the few minutes before my next appointment, I can still feel this email looming over me. I read through it again and cannot help but ask, what research supports the claims being made? If 2 million government employees are being encouraged to resign from their jobs, what evidence is backing this decision? What evidence points to the benefits of privatization, or the necessity of complete return to in-person work versus having provisions for virtual care? I reflect on the over 6 years I have worked at the VA and the impact I have seen on veterans' lives. I think about how my own position has evolved to provide virtual coverage to 3 of our smaller clinic locations, located hours apart, that are not large enough to support funding to have a provider on the ground at each site. With all these experiences, how can I readily accept that all of this could be so disposable? But as a healthcare professional, I am trained to not only rely on my own experiences, but to practice according to evidence-based medicine. Every single decision I make over the course of my day is informed by published peer-reviewed research. So much like if I was encountering an uncertain clinical situation, I turn to the evidence. 4 systematic reviews published in 2011, 2017, 2018, and 2023 have all shown that veterans get either the same or better care through VA healthcare. Studies from 2015 and 2017 showed better outcomes for PTSD and depression, respectively, from telemedicine-based collaborative care teams. A cohort study from 2024 shows that an increase in virtual mental health visits was associated with a significant decrease in suicide-related events. This evidence speaks loudly and clearly, and yet I'm still left with this pit in my stomach. I'm left feeling disheartened and discouraged. While I know the contents of that email will not pressure me to resign, I worry that my workplace will be drained of resources essential to the care of veterans in these coming months. I am left writing a letter to my Congress members asking that they consider the evidence and the consequences of these executive orders. But I am also left with the belief that my work is both meaningful and valuable, and that I will continue to show up to work regardless of the honeypotting and scare tactics residing in my inbox.
That essay was from a VA mental health clinical pharmacist practitioner. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the future of gender-affirming care in Wisconsin in light of the Trump administration's attempt to end funding for hospitals that provide that treatment. Plus, we'll hear from the new director of Milwaukee Recreation. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.